Today is the 1st of May, 2013. I am David Caruso. I'm here with Jody Roberts. We're at Carolina Meadows in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We're here to interview George Wyman. This will be the first session of a two-day interview. Thank you again for participating in this oral history project. What I'd like to do is I'd like to hear a little bit more about your childhood. From what I can tell, you were born on the 13th of October in 1921 in Budapest, Hungary. So I was hoping that we could kind of start from there, if I can hear a little bit about your childhood growing up, your parents.
Yes, Budapest had, at that time, in the 1920s, 1930s, had a very well-to-do, largely Jewish middle class. And my family was among these. And my father had a textile business. He was selling materials by the yard, by the meter, actually, and was doing very well financially. And I was born in 21, as you said, and when I got to be... Now, the European educational system is different from the American one. There we have, in Europe, you have 4 years of elementary school, which is just to read and write and talk, that sort of thing. And then 8 years of a secondary school, which is quite rigorous. And in Hungary, at the time of my childhood, the best school, generally recognized best school, was a private school run by the Lutheran Church. Mm-hmm. They owned it, operated, whatnot. It was not for exclusively for Lutherans, but if you were not a Lutheran, you paid an extra fee. Mm-hmm. Everybody had to pay a fee. It was not a public school. And my family thought that would be a good place for me to go when I was 10 years old, and I did. Among the alumni of the Lutheran school earlier than my entrance were Eugene Wigner, a Nobel laureate in physics, Princeton, and John von Neumann, recognized in general as the father of computers, mm-hmm. and another economist, just a couple of years older than I was, also got a Nobel Prize later on from that school. Not from that school, I mean, he went on other schools. So it was an outstanding school, there's no question about it. The other thing that, well, I was one of the best students in the school, my vintage. But as Hitler was making more and more inroads on Central Europe, my father was a pessimist, looked at my age and said, you're going to be military age just at the time when you're going to graduate, and you just can't have you stay here that long. Mm-hmm. So he insisted I drop out of my school one semester before graduating. So I'm a high school dropout. And arranged with friends of the family and whatnot to have somebody meet me when I arrived in New York, arrange visas and all that sort of thing, and shipped me off to the US. This was in the winter of 1939. I was 17 years old.
Did you come by yourself?
By myself, but I had friends in the family. I had a long list of people to look up and that sort of thing. And a couple of people especially were very helpful in getting me settled. But the object of the game was for me to continue my education in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the question was, well, will a university in the U.S. take a high school dropout from Hungary. My English knowledge of the language was very good. I spent 2 summers in England. So I was fluent in German and fluent in English. I had a smattering of Italian and French. All this is not unusual, because when you grow up in a country like Hungary, the Hungarian language is good 100 miles in each direction, and it ends. Then you get to the west, it's German, to the east, it's Romanian or Russian or Serbo-Croat or whatnot. The Hungarian language is lost. I mean, nobody speaks Hungarian unless you're born Hungarian. So every middle-class family in Hungary started their children on languages when they were 2 or 3 years old. We had what we called a governess. We had 2 children in the family. I had a younger sister. And by the time my sister was born, we had a governess who didn't speak Hungarian.
Mm-hmm.
She was German or Czech or something, but that was the language of the family was German, because German was an international language, Hungarian was not. And it was silly to look for a German speaking, a German and Hungarian speaking governess, because there weren't any. So.
I have a question. Were your mother and father from Hungary originally?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah.
So going generations back, they had been there?
A couple of generations.
You mentioned that your father was in textiles. Was your mother working at all, or no?
Mothers were not working those days. Women were not working those days.
Okay. So she stayed at home, taking care of
the
household?
Yes. Actually, my mother was ill much of the time, so she was in sanitariums, and we saw her about half the time. The other half, she was gone in healthcare. You know.
It was a chronic illness she was suffering from.
Yes, a variety of illnesses. We never really knew what they were.
Hmm.
And she was quite young, and she died in 1940. She was born in She was about 30 years old when she died.
Okay, so 1910-ish.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about what life was like for you? I want to know a bit more about what the education was like, even in the early years. But I also want to know a bit more what your home life was like at the time. You mentioned you were in a middle-class neighborhood.
My father believed in investing in real estate, so he bought an apartment house, and we had a large apartment in this apartment house.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had somebody else living in the apartment house who took care of the everyday thing. If the water system wasn't working, well, this guy would fix it or whatever. He didn't get personally involved. He just owned it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's things that may be hard for you guys to believe is hard for me to believe. And for toilet paper, we use newspapers. I mean, we were well off, upper middle class Hungarians. If you wanted a hot bath, you told the maid about a half hour beforehand. She'd go down the basement to get the coal, bring it up to the second floor to put fire to the coal, and a half hour later you'd have hot water.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it was. But the most amusing thing from my childhood that I still remember is this. As I said, my father was worried about the advance of the Germany occupation of Austria, 1938, and thought that I should, since I was just growing up, I was 16 at the time, I should have a profession. Mm-hmm. Originally, he wanted me to go in the textile business, but as the political situation got worse and worse, he didn't think that was a good plan. He had a small factory. He thought I'd inherit it, but then he sold his textiles out. He, who knew nothing about chemistry, said, "You should take up chemistry when you grow up." Why? He had visions of a chemist being somebody who could mix up all kinds of things and get some kind of a shoe polish out of this that he could sell at a good profit. Well, after I came to the U.S., I managed to get a pretty good chemistry education at Cornell. I got a doctorate, but I still wouldn't know how to make a shoe polish. I'm afraid my father would be disappointed. But that was his idea of chemistry. He knew nothing about chemistry. He only knew about textiles, and he made a very good living.
Yeah.
With his woolens and cotton and whatnot that he was selling in a store.
Had you had much technical training in your high school up to this point?
None. The high schools were very, very, well, you can imagine. At age 10, you started pretty serious stuff in high schools. You started a second language at age 10. It was German and Latin. So you had Hungarian, German, and Latin at age 10. You didn't have physics. You had math right away, yes, at age 10. There are more and more topics. By age 14, you had another language. In my school, you had a choice. You had either, you could choose English or ancient Greek, because ancient Greek was the traditional thing for a classical education.
Right.
Now in my class of 40, four kids chose ancient Greek and 36 went with English. But as I say, my English got especially good because the family could foresee my need for English, and they sent me out for two summers, when I was 13 and when I was 17, to England.
So what was making them think that they could foresee that you'd have a need for English? Was this just larger political awareness?
Wait a minute, foresee what?
You said that your family could foresee your need for English in the future.
Well, because Hitler was gobbling up Europe piece by piece. And by 1938, he was at the gates of Hungary. He had taken over Austria. And my father could see that there's nobody who would stand up to him. Mm-hmm.
But even as early as 13, so you would have been, that had been 1935.
Well, in 35, I think that was purely an academic exercise. Right. That you, growing up in Central Europe, the Hungarian language is useless. If you're going to do any traveling or something, then you need German and you need English. And yes, the way things were at 35, if you spoke German and you spoke English, the only place you couldn't get anywhere would be France. I mean, but you can't have everything. When I was 14, actually, I had a choice between French and Italian, and I took Italian, so I had some private tutoring in Italian, and I didn't try French until I was about 17, and I had very little of that. But
I'd love to hear about your experiences in England. What did you do while you were in England for the summer?
Sun myself. This was strictly just for the language. Uh-huh. And there was no... I got to London, there was a friend of my father's who was sort of an acquaintance, and he was going to look after me enough to get me settled somewhere along the sea coast. So those days there were a lot of ads in the English newspapers, what they call paying guests. Somebody had an extra bedroom,
mm-hmm.
and they were looking to rent it out for the summer for a kid or two, brother, sister, two brothers or something. And it cost X number of pounds, and you had it for the summer. So I spent both of those summers in the Brighton area, which is
mm-hmm.
the south coast of England. And there was one of them was a an English schoolmaster, actually. He had a whole bunch of kids staying there. He had a pretty big house. His backyard, we would play tennis. I mean, he'd made quite a business out of this.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was just a private family, an English doctor with one child, and they decided they had an extra room. And they were a 10-minute walk to the beach. And they advertised, and we answered, and I spent the summer there. And
so for both of these trips, did you travel there on your own?
Yes.
Okay, so at age 13...
My father took me on a trip when I was 14, 13, I think, on a Mediterranean cruise that touched a lot of places, wound up in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
That time was Palestine for a week. And the school had a trip to Italy. I went on that. Rome, Florence, Venice. I mean, these were the highlights of an Italian trip for kids. And then on my trip to the U.S., the family decided that, yes, there's a hurry, but the hurry is not such that you really have to take the first boat out, but you could actually do a little sightseeing. So I spent a week in Paris on the way to England, where I got the ship to come to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And Paris was very impressive. And there I met a fellow I used to know back in my school, who was on his way to Australia. And he also had about a week in Paris, so the two of us roamed around Paris. This was all 1938. On the other hand, there's a French family I met when I was in England, and I stopped in, visited them, and their daughters was about 3 years older than I was, and they said, "What, your family's worried about war? War? 1938 and 39? No question, no war." The French didn't take it seriously. And this was a very, very wealthy family. They lived near the Arc de Triomphe. Anyhow, this was a long time ago. And now, finding a college was a... In the first place, the way I could come out was only on a student's visa.
This is when you moved to New York?
To get the American visa. The immigration visas, I would have had to wait about 40 years to get an immigration visa, because the visas, the quota was used up for 40 years. That obviously was ridiculous. So the family, my father and his friends in the States, came up with the idea, come out on a student visa. But to be on a student visa, you had to be enrolled in a school that was on the State Department list of approved schools. And my family friend in the U.S., he didn't know much about me. He didn't know my education or anything like it. So he looked at the lists that were approved by the State Department, and he found a secretarial school to enroll me in. Secretarial school in New York, because he himself lived in New York at the time. And then he figured, you can always change schools. He If you went from one approved school to another approved school, you're fine. So as soon as I got there, he says, well, you're going to the secretarial school, and of course we know you don't want to learn how to type, but about once a week you should put in an appearance. And in the meantime, we look for the real thing. And I arrived early March. And then I started looking. I got my feet on the ground. And late in March, I started looking. I had an introduction to, among other people, John von Neumann. And he was a friend of, he was a cousin of a friend of my father's, and that sort of thing. And the word was everywhere, all the colleges in New York area, Princeton, that March was too late for entrance in September because all those slots were committed. Mm-hmm. So, at least in the New York area. And in the meantime, I felt New York was too big a place for me. I mean, too big a city. I still feel that way. And so I looked around, I said, what's there that's not too far from New York? Because I had some friends there, but far enough so it's not like New York. And somebody mentioned Cornell. I said, okay, let's try Cornell. So I wrote to Cornell, sent them, I had the copies of English translations of my report cards, whatnot, to submit to these schools, and the registrar at Cornell says, well, we like your credentials and we'd be happy to admit you, but we don't know at what level to admit you. So I told them what was true. I said I'd been to Columbia. And Columbia said if they had space, they would give me a year's credit for advanced credit. So Cornell says, all right, what's good enough for Columbia? They took my word for it. But actually, it was true. And all right, we'll admit you as a temporarily as a, with 1 year's advanced credit. Fine. I heard more about Cornell, and everything I heard was a good school. It was 200 miles from New York, 220 or something. And I entered Cornell, even though I was a high school dropout in Hungary. And then at Cornell, the question came up, what did they give me credit for? Because as a chemistry major, I had some requirements, say, in physics. Did I have physics credits or did I not have physics credits? So I went up to the dean and he didn't know. He sent me over to the physics faculty. And this was sort of interesting. Whoever was in charge of undergraduate education in physics says, have you got your notebooks, textbooks, whatever, from Hungary, physics notebooks. Mm-hmm. I figured, I said, yes, but they're in Hungarian. He said, that's all right, I want to see them. He didn't speak Hungarian any more than you do. What he was looking for, did I have differential equations that I've used in physics? Mm-hmm. And if I did, he'll give me credit. He didn't tell me that. But I had the stuff, I gave it to him, and he gave me another year and a half of credit. I mean, I'm sorry, 18 credits, that was a semester and a half of credit. Mm-hmm. So it turns out with the physics credit and the advanced credit, I finished the undergraduate school at Cornell in 2 years, so plus one summer.
One thing that I'm a little curious about, I mean, you mentioned that your family was from Hungary, and that's for a few generations. So how is it that your family had so many connections outside of Hungary? Was it just through your father's textile business? Was he shipping?
No, he was not shipping anything. He was selling. He was selling the retailer 20 yards of this,
mm-hmm.
10 yards of that, whatnot. No, this was because other people, Hungary was a pretty poor country. And some people tried to make a living, well, in Hungary and didn't do so well, and they thought the United States was. There is a man who was very famous, became very famous in Philadelphia, who was courting my mother before she married my father.
Mm-hmm.
But she decided to marry my father and not him. And he thought that America offered him more opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You guys ever go to concerts at the Academy of Music?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've heard of Eugene Normandy?
Have you?
Mm-mm.
No.
Well, he was the conductor and music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra for like 40 years.
Huh.
I'm sure he's dead now. So he had a different name in Hungary. He was a violinist. He didn't get anywhere. He came to the U.S. He played in a movie in an orchestra. Those days, the big movie theaters had their own orchestras in New York.
Mm.
And one day, the conductor, he just played the violin. And one day the conductor was sick or something, and they had him come up and conduct. And it turned out he was a great conductor. And Eugene Ormond is a phenomenon. And if you look at the records, classical records, there's just about everything. And so anyhow, and he was one of the people who sort of looked after me a little more through some of his sidekicks, people who worked for him. I mean, he was one of the best known conductors in the U.S. from 1935 to probably 1985 or 2000 maybe, and lived in Philadelphia in the Rittenhouse Square. I visited him a couple of times. So anyhow, he was one. And here's an example. He couldn't get anywhere in Hungary, and it was a big, big success in the U.S. Another friend of the family, my mother had very close friends when she was going to school, and one of her close friends had a brother who was trained as a chemist, and he wasn't getting anywhere in the U.S. in Hungary either. So he packed up and went to the U.S. and started his own chemical company.
So would you say that during the period that you were in Hungary, that U.S. was seen as the place to go if you couldn't make it where you were living?
It seems that way.
Okay.
In retrospect, I mean, it was not obvious at the time, but I think that a fair number of people who thought they could do better and they were not satisfied with what they are doing in Hungary and what they're accomplishing.
Mm-hmm.
They looked around the world, and now maybe some went to Australia, maybe some went somewhere, but a relatively large number went to the U.S. Now, of course, a violinist, you can't tell how good he is until he's in big competition, and it turns out that he wasn't all that good as a violinist, but as a conductor, he was probably a fourth or a fifth in the world.
Wow.
When he had a chance to conduct.
Mm-hmm.
This is, they had orchestras in Hungary. And I was there when he came back to conduct in Hungary in 1936, 1937. It was a big to-do about it. the famous conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra, was coming to play in Hungary. So yes, I had some help, and every family does, especially if you have a child going, they search their minds and see if there's anybody who emigrated who they know about. My closest friend for 70 years now is a fellow I met after I arrived in New York. He was a year younger than I was, but a friend of my mother's had this friend, and she knew that that lady emigrated a year before that with two sons, and one son was about my age. And it turned out they lived very near where I settled in New York. So I looked him up a couple of weeks after I got there, and this was 1939, and we're still friends. He lives in Orlando now with his second wife. And he had a big career with the CIA. Now he dropped out of high school 2 years before the finishing, and he looked to me to help him get the high school credit. And I was at Cornell. I told you what happened to me at Cornell. And well, he wasn't anywhere near a college. But I went to the same dean who gave me the advanced credit. By then I was well established. I think I was Phi Beta Kappa. So I said, now look, I have this friend. He's in the army. And the army will send him to the specialized training program if we could somehow say that he had the equivalent of a high school degree, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. So I got a letter from this dean at Cornell saying that if this fellow had gone to Cornell, he would have been a bunch of ifs, but the army bought it. Mm-hmm. But then the whole thing had a real silly ending. This was the beginning of the war. We weren't quite sure what was what, I think. Anyhow, my friend at that time was sent to Yale in a specialized training program based on what the Cornell dean said about me. And this was an immersion course in Japanese. Mm-hmm. Not even Japanese breakfast, Japanese everything. And when the course was over after 6 months, they shipped him to Europe. And then he wound up Army Intelligence, and then the OSS, and the CIA. Mm-hmm. He was the last CIA chief in Saigon as we were pulling out of Vietnam.
Oh. I guess he did make it out of Europe at some point, not clearly to Japan.
But he had a very stellar career with the CIA from, I saw him when he was in section, station chief in Vienna, in Bonn, in Mexico, so he was everywhere. In fact, his first wife left him because he was too damn busy. He always wanted to be out on the firing line, and she wanted to settle down and raise the kids. Sure. So, he had a very full life. He's now, I'm 91, he's now 90, and he lives in Orlando. But this business, the equivalency of the educational system, articles have been written on it, that the European, going back 50 years, 40 years, that the European educational system was about 4 or 5 years ahead of the American system. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was generally accepted. I think it has changed some. I don't know if there are any recent articles about it. But anyhow, I had the benefit of it. My friend had benefit. A lot of other people I know had the benefits of it. The president of the National Academy of Sciences wrote an article about that, but that was in 1960-55, I remember, because I met him then.
So I have a couple of questions. I do want to hear a lot more about your transition to the U.S. and your time at Cornell. But before doing so, I just want to sort of finish up with your time while you're still in Hungary. You mentioned having a younger sister. Did your parents have a similar plan for her in terms of coming to the U.S.?
You see, she was not on the firing line.
Mm-hmm.
At least as my father saw it, I was reaching military age. A, because I was older, and B, because I was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course he's right, 18 was military age in Hungary. So when I reached 18, he visualized that I would not get a passport to travel anywhere. So I had to go out before I was 18. That's why he yanked me out of school. My sister was 14 and a girl.
Mm-hmm.
When she got to be 18, her situation didn't change. It wasn't likely to change. So what the plans were as follows for the family. My mother was very ill, and she died within 6 months after I left. So that left my father and sister. My father was overage for the military. Oh, there's a funny story there. I told you my father was quite well off. When Ormandy came for a visit, he rented a car, was driving all over. That really impressed my father, and from there on, he wanted to have a car.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know how to drive, so he bought a car and bought a chauffeur to go with it. And he paid the chauffeur, I don't know what the going rate was, and the chauffeur took us here or there, excursions. Okay, so far so good. Well, then this was 1938, and the political situation was getting tighter and tighter. The Hungarians mobilized, and they decided there are not many cars in Hungary. They're going to mobilize all cars, all privately owned cars. They all go into the military. So here's my father. He bought a car. He's paying a chauffeur. The car goes in the military, and so is the chauffeur. No, I'm sorry, the car didn't go. Only the chauffeur gets drafted, and he goes in the military. My father now has a car, no chauffeur, and he can't really drive. So he says, I'm going to get them. So he hires a chauffeur who has a lame leg. And now, the next time the political situation gets even tighter, now the government decides they're going to mobilize all cars and all chauffeurs that go with the cars.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind if he's got a lame leg or not. So my father was without a car, and he had two chauffeurs in the military, and he had to pay their bill.
So he had to keep paying them?
Yeah.
Even after they'd been drafted?
Yeah, until the emergency was over.
Wow.
I mean, given that there was a lot of...
Two chauffeurs for one car.
Given that there was a lot of political awareness at the time, I was partly curious if your father was concerned with the fact that, I mean, war was going on. I mean, your father was just comfortable staying in Hungary. He didn't want to leave the country and avoid this mounting European conflict.
He didn't want to leave the country unless he had to, but he felt that he probably would have to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hungary's position during the war was a very, very mixed up position.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you want me to analyze it. It was a mess. Anyhow, my father decided that he and my sister would leave in 1940, which is a year after the war broke out. And he also had a girlfriend by then. And he was taking her, and he arranged visas and tickets and whatnot. And they were coming through Spain, and the only place you could get a visa for was Buenos Aires, Argentina. Mm-hmm. By boat, I think it was Spain or Portugal, I'm not sure which, but train to Spain, boat to Buenos Aires, and then hope to get to the U.S. from there somehow. Well, all plans don't work out. The boat took off from wherever it was, Lisbon or somewhere, and somehow the British got wind of some high-powered German intelligence people being on that ship. So they stopped the ship on the high seas and took it into a British base in the Caribbean. And they found the Germans that they thought they had them. And then they asked everybody on the boat, now, who were these Germans friendly with? And it turns out that my father's newfound girlfriend was quite friendly with the Germans. So they said, all right, we'll take her off too. This was at Trinidad is where they stopped. They stopped them and took them into Trinidad. And as they get the girlfriend off the boat, well, it turns out she can't really get off the boat with her belongings, because her belongings and my sister's belongings were put together into a couple of suitcases. Well, the British didn't care, took my sister off. Uh-huh. Well, the sister was 14, so she couldn't go off alone, so who's she with? Her father took him off. Everybody got off the boat. Mm-hmm. So they were stuck in Trinidad for 6 months because no boat had room to go to South America. Everybody wanted to go to South America. So at the end, they finally got to Buenos Aires, and then a couple of years, a year or so later, they came to the U.S.
So they came to the U.S. while you were still in
college?
I was
at Cornell.
You were at Cornell. And where did they settle?
New York.
New York City? Or
New York City.
And that's where they stayed for the rest of... Okay.
For a long time. My sister is now in California, but she was in the New York area until 15 years or so.
You mentioned that the gymnasium system was quite rigorous. So I'm guessing that from your early age of 10, you were probably heavily invested in your studies. You also mentioned that you had done quite well at school. But I am curious to know two things. One, whether or not you were participating in things outside of school or in addition to school. Like, did you play tennis? Did you read books a lot? Were you in the backyard mixing chemicals together to make shoe polish?
I was captain of the water polo team. Water polo is a great Hungarian sport. Huh? Mm-hmm. I was captain of the water polo team when I was 16. And our school was never very noted for athletic ability. It was mainly brains. Mm-hmm. So everybody was surprised when we made the finals in the National Water Polo Championship, but we didn't get very far. But I was captain of the water polo team, and I did some individual swimming, got a couple of medals, scholastic medals. What else? I made the second team in ice hockey. Again, our school was never very good at ice hockey. So yes, I did participate, and I was fencing. As a matter of fact, my fencing was good enough, so when I got to Cornell, I continued the fencing, and I was on the Cornell fencing team while I was an undergraduate.
What was your weapon of choice?
Saber.
Saber. So the
but
other...
again, fencing is a traditional Hungarian, they won a lot of Olympic medals, just like water polo is. And at Cornell, very few people are interested in fencing.
In terms of your education while in Hungary was, you mentioned that your father said, oh, you should become a chemist.
Hmm?
Your father mentioned that he thought you should go into chemistry.
Yeah.
Was there something that you were interested in doing? Did you want to be a historian, for example, or?
Geography was my favorite subject.
Mm-hmm.
My father's suggesting chemistry was enough for me when I got to Cornell. I signed up as a chemistry major, but I could have changed. But it so happened that Cornell had a very good chemistry professor for freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
The elementary chemistry course was very, very well taught and made it very interesting. So,
do you remember who that was?
Yeah. A.W. Lobengeier, you want to write this down, I'll spell it for you. I think he's dead now. Laubengeier. He was a professor. And he was very good. He gave very good lectures. He may not have been completely up to date on the quantitative aspects of inorganic chemistry, but he certainly got the attention of his people, his audience. Ah.
And so that solidified
things? Let's see if I can stretch out my leg.
Sure.
I think I'll just go back a little. Yes, Lobengeier. I mean, if this lecture had been bad one, I would have probably looked around to see what else I could learn, but he was good, and from there on everything was, and the next one was very good too. Organic chemistry was next course, and he was an excellent lecturer.
Was it at all difficult transitioning from Hungary to the United States? I mean, there are different cultures. The U.S. is, let's see, by the time you were here, it was probably improving in terms of its economy, though it had been hit pretty hard with the Great Depression. Was it difficult being in the U.S., transitioning to the way of life here?
Well, I had a little bit of money the family gave me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, money meaning dollars. And enough to pay for entering Cornell. And the people were all very nice, very friendly. The students were all very nice, very friendly. And perhaps thanks to the two summers in England, I don't know, I adapted quite easily. I mean, it's a different culture, yes, but still, it was painless. I always, almost every summer, we spent the summer abroad from Hungary, much of the time in what was then Yugoslavia, and and there we had international friends. I mean, international resorts, they came from all over. And so all that was fairly easy. And yet, I had a few Hungarian friends, these friends of the family, a bit like my friend in Orlando. I mean, we were friends. He has no interest, no knowledge of chemistry, and we had a lot in common. We grew up together, and we were together when the Germans invaded Russia. And we spent a lot of different times together over, what is it, 70 years.
Were you able to keep track of what was happening with your family while you were? Were you able to keep track of what was happening with your family while you were at Cornell?
Yes. Well, we corresponded while I was at Cornell for a while, and then my father packed up and left for Buenos Aires, which took him about a year to get to, but in the meantime, yes, we could correspond when he was in this internment camp. And in 1940s, if you were going to be interned anywhere, you the Caribbean was a
Trinidad is probably
choice,
yeah,
a choice place to be.
Yeah,
I mean, it was not the not like being a present in Trinidad hotels or something, but certainly no great danger of any sort.
Mm-hmm.
They were safely stashed away in a British internment camp until they found a ship that would stop and had room to take them. And it took 6 months because ships were full and they didn't take people.
Mm-hmm.
And then they stayed in New Orleans, in Buenos Aires for a couple of years or something like that. So,
when your father got into New York, did he take up textiles again?
Yes, but at a very low level. He could not become an entrepreneur. He was working for other people. It was very hard for him, and also didn't speak much English, which was also another hardship. So after a couple of years after the war, he went back to Hungary, tried to reopen the old business, and that didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
By then the communists were knee deep in the business world in Hungary, and there was no hope. So then he came back and lived a few more years than that. A lot of Hungarian men who, especially the ones who had a position, I mean, reached some sort of a position in their adult life, when they came to the U.S. where they had to start all over, they found it very difficult. They frequently escaped and went back to Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
My friend in Orlando, his father went back.
Mm-hmm.
He was a bank director.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not all, but frequently.
Mm-hmm.
It was bad for the fathers.
So when you got to Cornell, you were, I think, based on what you said, it sounds like you were coming in with the equivalent of maybe a second year
first
student.
First a sophomore, but then they upped it to almost a junior.
Closer to a junior. So
I had to complete 2 years of undergraduate work plus one summer session. And
okay.
That was it.
Okay, so you're sort of a second semester sophomore coming in as an undergraduate.
Right.
You mentioned you had a great entry-level chemistry professor.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear a little bit more about what made him just a great professor. Was it just his lecture style?
His lecture style. It was very good.
Did you have to, were there laboratory components to your classes? And what were those laboratory components like? Was it just a predefined project that you had to, you know, pour A into B, see what happens?
That's right.
Okay.
They told you exactly what to do. He's asking me now to think back at 19... I entered Cornell in 1939.
It's only 70 years ago. I'm sure you remember it just like yesterday.
1939.
Sure.
So pretty much from the outset, you mentioned that you weren't necessarily... you entered as a chemistry major, but you wouldn't... You made it sound as if you would consider doing something else, possibly.
Yes.
Was there ever a time at Cornell that you thought to yourself, actually, I don't want to do chemistry? No.
No.
Okay.
After my undergraduate degree, after 2 years, I was fully committed.
Okay.
And now when we come down to chemistry, at Cornell in graduate school, you had to choose. You're going to major in organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry, physical chemistry, or what? And I was always a fish out of water. The organic chemist looked upon me as a physical chemist, and the physical chemist looked upon me as an organic chemist. And then much later, I really became a photochemist. And I guess when I was growing up, there was no such thing as yes, there was. Mm-hmm. There were very few schools had photochemistry. It was mainly vapor phase photochemistry, which was not on the organic photochemistry really developed in the 1950s. And here I have something I don't think I ever gave it to you. Is that the photochemistry one? Yes. This I think is a pretty good description of sort of an autobiographical description of how and why I landed in photochemistry accidentally. Now there is a tremendous revolution, of course, after the war in chemistry. You guys are too young to know this. And that all involved instrumentation. Mm-hmm. I mean, today you go into a chemistry laboratory and you got instrument after instrument after instrument. There was no such thing in 1939, 19. And spectroscopy was the first, and I had the good fortune of, well, maybe I'm jumping ahead of it. Okay, I'll take a chance. I finished Cornell. Now, there are a couple of things that happened at Cornell. No, one happened at Cornell, one later. I got very concerned about ethics in chemistry. I got stung by an unethical chemist at Cornell. I got stung by an unethical chemist in my second industrial job. And then later on, by a university professor.
So, go ahead. I was just going to, just for clarity, when you say your second industrial job, are you talking about at General Aniline and Film Corporation?
Right. Okay. The first two were very similar.
Can you explain what you mean by unethical?
All right. It's really quite simple. I was at Cornell and studied on my master's. And this war was going full blast. Cornell faculty was in Pittsburgh and Chicago, wherever, hardly anybody in Ithaca. Mm-hmm. So the only professor I could work for was a young man named Bill Miller. And Bill Miller was a very fine chemist. And Bill Miller said, well, we have you here for a master's. Well, the first thing I'd like you to do, he says, I had this fellow working for me last year, and he finished his master's work, and his name, I only remember his first name, his name Harry somebody, okay. But Harry synthesized this compound, and it's all in his thesis. So why don't you start by synthesizing Harry's compound? And now I don't remember what Bill Miller wanted me to do with the compound, but he wanted me to pursue something beyond what Harry had done. But to do it, I had to synthesize the compound. And it was all described in detail in the master's thesis. And I follow it step by step, and I don't get his damn compound. And I do it again and again and again, and it still doesn't have the property, I don't know, didn't have the melting point, didn't have the, I don't know what, but it obviously, I was not getting what he said he was getting. So I went back to Bill Miller and said, well, look, I can't get what Harry got, what Harry said he got. At this point, Bill Miller doesn't know. Will Harry cheat, or am I a dodo? It's one or the other. And I don't know how that was resolved, but he finally gave up on the whole thing, gave the new project to work on it. Everything went on. I met Harry at a meeting later on. I said, Harry, Bill gave me he wanted me to continue working on your compound, and I couldn't make it. And then Harry said, by then he was in industry. And then he said, well, you know, George, it wasn't quite exactly the way I described it in the thesis. Hmm. Well, that's enough. I mean, that means that the thesis was a fluke. And we gave up on it. And as I say, the guy is probably dead by now. I don't know what this was, but I had to do something completely different from Masters. And believe it or not, about 5 years later, the same thing happened at General Allen. I was a new guy. I'd been there about a year, and the big chief was a chief of the laboratory was a, this was at the end of the war, no, after the war just ended. This guy was a older German chemist, Austrian really. They imported from Austria, and he was he worked for the big German cartel, the BASF, and originally, and he came to work in New Jersey, and he put me to work. He says there's a guy named Price Truett. He left us a year ago, and I want you to repeat what he did, and then we want you to do something beyond. So I get his report, did the thesis, and I repeat exactly what he did. And now this was a dye company, and the ultimate test on all dye companies is there's a dye lab which has a very controlled way of dyeing fabrics. And then the human eye decides, in my case this was a bright yellow dye, and the end result should have been a bright yellow dye. And by the time they got through, I did the synthesis, and they dyed the standard batch of cotton. Instead of bright yellow, it was kind of bleh. It was sort of a light beige. It obviously was not what it was supposed to be. Well, in this case, the guy who left, he got some bright yellows. How did he get it? Well, he could have gotten it one or two ways, by going through the procedure that he outlined, or by going through half the procedure, because he'd gotten some imported intermediate. It was a five-step synthesis, and after step three, if he took some out of that tin box that came from Germany and did the last two steps using that intermediate and not what he made, then maybe that intermediate will give you the bright yellow, but using the stuff he made will give you a blah, which is what it was. Well, the lab director really was mad. How can this happen? Am I no good, or is the other guy a crook? And this time he's decided he's going to do it himself. I mean, he had all the know-how of 30 years of synthesizing dyes. And and he stayed in the lab over the weekend or whatnot. He made his stuff directly from A to Z, and it came bleh. So he decided it wasn't me, it was the other guy who apparently took the German intermediate. But he couldn't make it all the way from A to Z. He took it at the halfway point, the German intermediate, and then he got nice bright light. Again, I met him at a meeting later on. I said, you know, I said, this report, you had this dye in your report, and it came out beautiful yellow. And when I tried to repeat it, it didn't come out beautiful. Well, yes, some of the time I did use that intermediate and imported it. So these sort of things made me very, very sensitive to ethics. And then I discovered, then I had one more thing that was quite different. Then I discovered that unlike most big societies, the ACS did not have an ethics committee. The British have a real serious ethics committee that have sort of quasi-legal procedures. And if that quasi-legal procedure finds you guilty, like in these two cases they would have, the guy's tossed out of the society. Well, I started agitating to have an ethics committee in the ACS, and I used my political influence in that. I had friends, Ernest Elio was a friend who was a former president of the ACS, also a former resident here until he died about 7 or 8 years ago. Other people I knew who were quite high up in the ACS, and we went through about 4 or 5 years of hearings and whatnot and committee meetings, and finally it came up for a vote in your city when the ACS met there about 10 years ago or something. And the vote was to table. They still didn't want to take a chance on a watered down version of an ethics committee. And finally, a year later, at another ACS meeting, where we had a new president, he helped push it through. And ACS now has an ethics committee, but it doesn't have the bite that the British have in theirs.
So was that an issue? Was that an issue you stayed involved with through ACS during that entire period?
Well, I was involved on that one topic. I attended a fair number of ACS meetings after I retired. Now, we got a big long jump there, but I was a consultant to university chemistry laboratories, chemistry departments, including University of Pennsylvania, where I was twice. The name, fellow with an Italian name like yours, what was it, Pellegrino? He was the sort of the assistant chairman of the chemistry department, George, at the University of Pennsylvania. I don't know if he's still there or not. This was years ago. Pellegrino. Started with a P, an Italian name. George.
We could always try to look it up. We can always try to look it up later.
Well, you can look it up in the directory of the graduate studies going back 10 years, 15 years or so. He had me there talking to his faculty. The consulting I did for the chemistry departments was advise faculty, especially younger faculty, on how best approach research supporting agencies to get some money. Either by giving them tips for new supporting agencies that they didn't know about, or the ones they knew about, but how what sort of thing the agency is likely to be looking for. Since I was director of one of these agencies for, I don't know, 20 years or something. But that's just part of
Maybe we do want to go all the way back and fill in the time at Cornell?
Sure.
All right, can we take a quick break?
Yeah, we can take a break. We'll stop this.